My cord is in the way. Did that work? Okay, the Senate Committee on Human Services will come to order. Welcome, everybody, to the first day of committee on our short session. We have four bills that have been assigned to us. We have them all set for a public hearing and work session today. We have all of the paperwork on all of the bills, so it is possible that we will be able to work through all of them today, depending on your feelings about these things. We've had public hearings on all but one of them several times in the past. Before we get started, we have a lot of new people with us, a new member, a new committee administrator, a new committee assistant, and wanted to give each of you a chance to introduce yourselves. We'll start with Catherine.
Jamie Hens.
And Rob Wagner, State Senator from Senate District 19, Lake Oswego, Westland, Tualatin, Southwest Portland, River Grove, Durham. Representing the only Senate district that has Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties. I just learned that from Senator Devlin 2 days ago. So,
yeah. It's good to know what makes you unique.
Yes, there you
it's
go.
It's really important. Yeah. All right, so I'm going to open up an organizational meeting. And we've got our committee rules. Are there any substantial changes from what they have been in the past?
No, there are not.
All right. Senator Knope.
Chair Gelso, I move to adopt the committee rules dated February 6, 2018.
Senator Knope moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 6th of 2018. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Okay.
February 6th is Ronald Reagan's birthday. I just thought I'd throw that in.
Happy birthday, Ronald Reagan. His library is kind of cool in Southern California. That's a good vacation destination. All right. Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. I'll close the organizational meeting on committee rules. And I am going to open up a public hearing. I'm going to tell you the order that we're doing these things in. We're going to do 1555. And then, we're going to do 1555, and then we'll do 1525, 1526, and 1540 last, because that's what most of you are here for. So we're going to let the people that are only here for a few things get in and out quickly. So I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1555. Senator Steiner Hayward. Hayward. I have never mispronounced your name before. That was a...
Quite all right. And you would be one of the only people who's never mispronounced my name, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator, District 17. And I'm here today to tell you about Senate Bill 1555, which is, in the grand keeping of the intent of short session, both a technical fix bill and a budget bill. The Senate Bill 1555 fixes a minor problem on a temporary basis. Currently, retail cannabis tax revenues are deposited into the Mental Health, Alcoholism, and Drug Services account. And this is the same fund where beer and wine tax goes. And the statute dictates that 40% of the fund is distributed to counties based on population. 40% goes to OHA to be used for state matching funds to counties for alcohol and drug abuse, prevention, early intervention, and treatment services. And 20% is appropriated to OHA for the same services for inmates and parolees. So in 2017, the co-chair of Human Services Sub and I, Representative Rayfield and I, allocated $16 million of this cannabis revenue toward community mental health treatment, which we believe was very important given the frequency of co-occurring substance misuse disorders and other mental health issues. Oftentimes, substance use disorders come as a result of self-treatment of other mental health issues. Unfortunately, despite the name of the account, it turns out that statute says it can only be used for drug and alcohol treatment. It cannot be used for any other mental health programs. So this bill does one thing and one thing only. It, with the Dash 1 amendment, which you have in front of you, and I gather you have the paperwork for, which is good, allows us to use funds for community mental health just for this biennium. The Dash 1 creates a sunset. With that Dash 1, to the best of my understanding, there is support or at least neutrality from everybody on this bill. It will require some ongoing conversation during the rest of this biennium to understand the best ways to use these dollars to support it, and we will be having these conversations with the counties, the mental health programs, the health authority, and other interested parties over the next 12 months as we figure this out. But so you can expect to see some other version of this coming your way in a 19 session near you. But otherwise, this is a very straightforward, simple, technical fix budget bill.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Senator Center Hayward? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have one other person signed up to testify in this bill. I'm having trouble with pronunciation today. Jesse Bontacon?
Bontacue,
welcome. And is there anybody else that wants to be heard on this bill? Going, gone. All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so very much. In general, I work for the Oregon Retailers of Cannabis Association. We represent about 250 businesses in Oregon in the industry. In general, just wanted to say that we support mental health authorities or health authorities having the flexibility to spend money how they want. We do not oppose this bill or the change as it, so long as nothing increases taxes on cannabis, we're happy for people to have the flexibility to address problems as they see fit.
All right. Thank you so much. Wait, are there any questions?
Sorry.
There aren't.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And one more time, is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 1555. Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1555. Are people comfortable opening a work session on 1555?
Sure.
Yes. All right. I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 1555.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments.
Senator Knope moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1555. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1555 as amended to the floor. I do pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 1555 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? No? All right. Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. It's off to Ways and Means. We do not have to assign a carrier because it's going to Ways and Means. Did we get the first bill of the session out, or did somebody pass a bill this morning already?
Someone passed one yesterday.
Oh. I just wanted us to be the overachievers. Because we always meet for so long in here, it would be really exciting if our committee completed its work plan early. All right, so I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 1555 and opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1525. And Jamie, could you give us a description of the bill?
Happy to, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1525 exempts child caring agencies that provide adoption placement services but not care to children and which do not receive public funds from the requirement to provide financial statements that have been reviewed by an independent certified public accountant. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and there is no subref.
Great. So I have a question. There are people signed up for this bill that I didn't expect to see signed up for this bill, and I'm wondering if they thought it was Senate Bill 1526. So I have Bob Junedef. Did you want to testify on the adoption agency bill? No. Joanne Southey, did you want to testify on the adoption agency bill? Ben Lucian and Kurt Toombs, did you want to adopt?
No.
Do you want to adopt? Will you adopt me? Is there a different sign-in sheet for 1525? Sorry about that. Thank you. No worries. Nobody signed up on Senate Bill 1525. There we go. So if you'll recall from the interim, this just takes out, we're currently requiring adoption agencies that receive no public money at all and never take care of children to submit expensive audits and financial reviews to the state. This says we're not going to do that to them anymore. All right. Anybody want to be heard on that? All right. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1525. Can we open a work session on this? Open a work session on Senate Bill 1525.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1525 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 1525 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Linthicum, would you like to carry this bill?
Say what?
Or we could give it to Senator Wagner. Either way.
Yeah. He's the new kid.
Yeah, the new kid on the block.
All right.
Bring it on.
All right. Be prepared.
I know. Been around the building long enough to know what that means.
Yes. Oh, this will be a fun one. All right. I'm going to close the work session on There's a tradition of when a new member carries their first bill on the floor. It's a lengthy discussion. All right, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1525 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1526. Could you give a summary of the bill with the dash amendments?
Yes. Senate Bill 1526 prohibits courts from considering the termination of parental rights due to the finding of unfitness based solely on emotional illness, mental illness, intellectual, or other recognized disabilities. It declares an emergencies effective on passage, and the dash one amendment requires the court to consider mental health the mental health condition of the parents if the nature and duration renders the parent incapable of giving the proper care for the child for an extended period of time. It also prohibits the court from considering parents' disability unless the parent's disability-related conduct is of a nature and duration as to render the parent incapable of providing care for an extended period of time. We got the fiscal and impact statements back, and there's no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
Great, thank you very much. And the amendment is language that was worked on very hard between the Department of Justice and Disability Rights Oregon. They worked really hard into last week, so I really appreciate the time that people are willing to put into that at the end of the period. Could we please have Bob Jundiff, Bob Lucian, and Kurt Toombs, and Joanne Southey, please? Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Grelzer, members of the committee. My name is Bob Jundiff. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon. And thank you for hearing Senate Bill 1526. As we have learned from a very concerning case from Central Oregon, that sometimes the disability discrimination can creep into legal processes that consider the termination of a parent's rights. And that's why we brought forward this bill. And really, in many ways, this bill is, we'd suggest, one step of a two-step process. And what we're trying to do with this particular bill is just to address how the state statute reads that sets forth the criteria for the things that a judge should consider when making the difficult decision about whether to terminate a parent's rights. And right now, the way that the statute reads, developmental disability, mental illness are put way up front in the statute in such a way as it seems to imply that if a person has those disabilities, the burden of proof is now on them to demonstrate that they can be adequate parents. Once this case came to light, Disability Rights Oregon received many calls from parents, and primarily the people who were afraid. They were afraid that somehow their disability was going to result in their being the focus of folks from the government who are questioning their ability to parent, even though they haven't been had any problem with their children, there hasn't been any danger or things of that sort. So that's really the genesis of from our perspective, of this bill. And in talking with the Attorney General's office, we attempted to seek the proper balance between balancing the important safety considerations for children and to assure that parents are not discriminated against, and to word the statute in a way that achieves that. The Attorney General's office and we felt that the language that we've arrived at in the dash one amendments takes care of that. So that's what we're supporting today before you.
Thank you.
What do you want?
No, you go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair Gelser and members of the Human Services Committee. And to say many of the things that Bob right here just said, I'm Ben Luskin from Eugene, Oregon, and I'm a member of the leadership of Oregon ADAPT. I'm also a father of two beautiful daughters whose parenting rights was challenged by their mother due to my existence as a brain injury survivor. I'm here today with Kurt Toombs, right behind me, who's also a part of the leadership of Oregon ADAPT and the chief executive officer for Eastern Oregon Center for Independent Living. Oregon ADAPT is a grassroots community that organizes Oregon disability rights activists to engage in nonviolent direct action, including civil disobedience, to assure the civil and human rights of people with disabilities to live in freedom. Oregon ADAPT supports SB 1526 and applauds all the great work that went into this legislation as an effort to protect the parental rights of people with disabilities. This is one piece of a larger structure that we strongly believe requires ongoing review and change to protect rights of people with disabilities. Currently, parents with disabilities are under a persistent threat of losing their children, either in a custody battle or from child protective services, simply because they live with disabilities. One of the more recent cases, which Bob alluded to, where a child or children were removed from their family because their parents live with a disability, occurred in Bend. And this event received national attention from a variety of sources. It is our concern that there is not adequate and specific protection under the current statutes to ensure parents with disabilities are given the same considerations that parents who do not have disabilities are afforded. If parents with disabilities should have their parental rights terminated, it should be based exclusively on behavior and not disability condition. It is also our concern that parents with disabilities are not currently receiving adequate access to accommodations or support services that empower them to protect the health, safety, or welfare of a child or ward. The Americans with Disability Acts, or the ADA, provides for equitable treatment of persons with disabilities under the law. The term reasonable accommodation is a well-defined term from the ADA. In this case, it refers to the right of the parent or parents to receive help suitable to achieving equity. Oregon ADAPT requests for the formation of a statewide legislative-sponsored committee comprised of Disability Rights Oregon, Oregon ADAPT, persons with disabilities, disability scholars, representatives from Centers for Independent Living, community stakeholders, and policymakers to continue efforts to address discriminatory legislation toward people with disabilities and to determine accommodation and support services protocols. Let's let this one step forward with SB 1526 serve as a catalyst for positive, ongoing change in Oregon's attitude toward people with disabilities. Thank you, Madam Chair Gelser and members of the Human Services Committee, for providing us the opportunity to share Oregon ADAPT's position on protecting the rights of parents living with disabilities.
Thank you.
I'm Joanne Southey with the Oregon Department of Justice, Deputy Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I just want to take a moment to thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to collaborate on language on this amendment, and also to Bob Jundeff at Disability Rights Oregon to sit down and discuss these important issues. It's imperative that Oregon's laws and statutes reflect current appropriate terminology and language, and also be clear and non-offensive and non-stigmatizing. And it's for this reason that the Oregon DOJ supports the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1526. The Dash 1 amendment to this bill modifies the language in ORS 419B504, which is the termination of parental rights statutes, regarding one of the factors a court must consider before it can terminate parental rights. Such a significant action by the state requires careful consideration by the court of whether a parent's conduct or condition rises to a level that is seriously detrimental to the child, and if so, whether reintegration of that child into the parent's home is improbable within a time that's reasonable given that child's particular needs. Subsection 1 of the current statute uses multiple outdated and stigmatizing terms to encapsulate a range of conditions the court must consider in making these difficult determinations. Replacing the statute's current language with the term mental health condition is a positive step towards ensuring that the type and severity of the parent's mental or emotional illness or mental deficiency must cause the parent to be incapable of providing care properly for the child for extended periods of time before it can be considered by the court. For example, there are many people with personality disorders or low cognitive functioning who are successfully parenting their children. Similarly, there may be a person with those same conditions who engage in conduct related to that condition that are seriously detrimental to their child. This change reinforces the interpretation that Oregon courts have placed on these statutes for years, that a mental health condition in and of itself is not a basis to terminate a parent's parental rights. The new reference in the statute to the Americans with Disability Act of 1990 will ensure that parents with disabilities are treated fairly and equitably within the parameters of the law, while also providing a child with a safe and stable home in the event their parents' conduct related to their disability cannot be remedied within a reasonable time. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? I just, again, want to thank you all for, I know it was a lot of work and a lot of collaboration, and there was a point at which I was worried that it wasn't going to get there, but as usual, you all made it happen. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 1526? No? All right, then I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1526. Are we okay to open a work session? All right, opening a work session on Senate Bill 1526.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendments dated February 1st, 2018.
Senator Knope moves to adopt the -1 amendments dated February 1st, 2018. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1526 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 1526 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Bunce-Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an extremely important bill, and it's personal for me, too. My sister is totally deaf, has been from birth, and she has some friends who are deaf that people thought they were mentally challenged. They actually weren't, but they were at risk of losing their children. And it's just a matter of educating everybody that if you have a disability, it doesn't mean you cannot parent. So I'm very happy that this bill is going through.
Senator Knope.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. I want to thank the chair for responding to the concern that was expressed in the interim and making this a committee bill and getting it going. Local constituents of mine, Eric and Amy, I think in their case appeared to have discrimination against them based on their disability. And they were without their kids for a period of months, over a year. And a judge recently returned their youngest child to them, which I thought was the right decision. But it was clear that there were other people who were in jeopardy as well. And so I think it's really important that the Oregon legislature address the policy issue. And in Oregon, to show that we are inclusive and that we want to help people keep their kids, not take them away simply because we believe that they may not be able to parent. And I think there was lacking of evidence, and at least the case that I saw, that they should not have their kids. And I thought the case for the state was very weak, and so I think it is one of the most important bills that we're going to do this session, and I'm glad we have the opportunity. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I would just say the two of you are new, but to this committee. In the short session, each committee gets three bills, and one of the bills needs to be a bill that's agreed upon by the vice chair and the chair. This particular bill has the unique distinction of having been requested independently by every member of the committee last summer, saying this issue is going on, can we do something about it. I think that it's important to acknowledge that the court did its job in this case, and we should be cognizant that this goes to the language of the statute and it is talking about what happens at the moment of termination of parental rights. This does not necessarily go back to that point of removal, and I think that goes to the point raised by ADAPT, which is that we have more work to do. I have found that a lot of times when we do a statutory work group where everything is written down and there's reports that are due on particular days, sometimes that becomes pretty cumbersome to do the work. But as a committee, we can put together a work group, and I would like to put together a work group to work on that in the interim with the representatives that you've talked about with DHS as well, to look at how we can make sure we have really good training, being able to recognize bias, looking at accommodations. And I know that already the department over the last few months has really started to break down the barriers between child welfare and their developmental disability program around resources that might be available earlier on. And I think that is an important thing that's come out of the discussion that we've had over the last few months. But thank you, everybody, for asking for this bill and for people for continuing to work on it so we could move it for this small step forward this session.
Madam Chair, just quick question. I appreciate the emergency clause on here, but are there other cases that might be caught up in legal limbo right now, or what is the strategy for sort of message coordination on the change in statute out there? I was just curious. I know we're on consideration of the measure, but...
Correct.
Yeah. I was just curious if there's another case that's similar to this right now.
I am not personally aware of a specific other case, but it's hard to know where things are moving. And again, since this is at that termination of parental rights piece, that's going to be the decision that's made by the judge. I think part of the discussion that we had going back and forth was whether this is a policy change or if it's a wording change by pulling out that language. I think one of the reasons the amendment is there is the initial language that we brought forward would have challenged some long-standing interpretations of law, and the smaller step maybe helped us take a step forward without being disruptive. Am I describing that in the right way? Okay, the Department of Justice is shaking its head yes.
Thanks, that's helpful.
Thanks. Any further discussion? Nope, seeing none. Is there any objection? Seeing none, Senate Bill 1526 passes and goes to the floor. Senator Knope, would you like to carry this bill?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. So Senator Knope will be the carrier. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1526 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1540. And I want to say before we... Brett Post is here. Excellent. That was my first pause. So the way that we're going to do this, because there are several different elements to the bill, and different ones of you are here to speak to different discrete elements of what is something of an omnibus bill. So what we are going to do is have the introduction to the measure as a whole. Representative Post and I will give our overview of the bill as a whole. Then we will do the school district investigation piece. Then we will do the OWAPI piece. And then we will do the mandatory reporting of consensual sexual behavior piece. So that's the order that we'll go in. I think I know who you all are based on how you signed up. So would you like to give the summary? And Senator Post, Representative Post, and I will head down to the front. And I'll leave you with the gavel.
Senate Bill 1540 exempts from the definition of abuse any sexual contact or intercourse between a child over age 14 and a person under age 21 if the person is not 3 or more years older than the child and sexual contact is not the result of force, intimidation, or coercion. It also expands the definition of adult to include a person who is receiving mental health treatment in a community programs, facility, or state hospital for treatment of substance abuse or mental illness, and this includes in the definition of community program providers whose services are paid for directly or indirectly by the Oregon Health Authority. The Dash 1 amendment authorizes the Department of Human Services or law enforcement agency to conduct abuse investigations on school premises, and it also requires the department or agency conducting the investigation to present adequate identification to school staff members. It requires the school staff members to cooperate with the investigation and, at a minimum, allow the department or agency conducting the investigation access to the child and a private space to interview the child. It prohibits the school administrators and staff from notifying any person of the investigation other than the department, law enforcement, and school employees necessary to enable the investigation. It also clarifies that information obtained during the investigation is not part of the child's school record. And finally, the -2 amendment changes the age for the child involved in the sexual contact or intercourse for purpose of exemption from the definition of abuse from age 14 to age 12.
Do you mind if I start?
No.
I'll do them. All right. For your record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Corvallis and Albany and the surrounding areas. And this is my one bill for the session. This bill started as a fix-it bill for some issues we talked about in the last session around investigation of abuse of adults, especially around mental health illness and substance abuse. But I'm going to go through the bill in the same order that I described before. So the first piece is what you have encapsulated in the -1 amendment. There was a several years ago, there was an appeals court ruling that had to do with child abuse interviews of children being done on a school campus when the parents had not been notified that that took place. Since that time, that ruling has been repealed, but it has left a lot of discomfort and confusion and concern for school districts that want to make sure that they are complying with laws and not facing liability for allowing somebody to access a child at school. We addressed this issue in the last legislative session, and we thought that we had a fix that gave everybody what they needed, but as it got out into the field, there was still a little bit of confusion. So the only thing that this does, it clarifies that the Department of Human Services does have the authority to conduct a child abuse investigation on a school campus, and that investigation can include an interview of a child. It also clarifies that the school district is allowed to ask the Department of Human Services worker for identification to demonstrate that they are, in fact, from the Department of Human Services. All of the stakeholders that have worked on this have come together. It's consensus language. Nobody opposes that. I think it's good, and it will help us get these investigations done appropriately and also provide the protection that school districts need. The base bill itself was about how abuse investigations happen for people that experience mental illness and people with substance abuse disorders. The first piece is it extends for the first time the authority of for abuse investigations to be done in residential drug treatment facilities. What's really important to keep in mind about this piece is it's only when the person is receiving that residential treatment. This bill describes abuse as something that happens to a particular kind of person. The definition of that person is a person that is receiving those residential treatment services. So one of the questions I've gotten was if Bob goes to drug and alcohol treatment, a residential program, and he discloses to his therapist that he's a victim of domestic violence at home, is that program then required to mandatory report that, which would be a violation of his privacy as an adult? They are not, because that did not happen while he was inpatient or in a residential program. It's just while they're in the program. What we want is that ability for licensing authorities to be able to provide oversight for the safety of residential programs. The second piece is that the statute, as it currently is written, talks about individuals who are receiving services that are provided by a community mental health program. As you know, we implemented CCOs, and in some places, money now flows through the CCO instead of directly through the community mental health program. So we basically have a legislative fix to identify the many different ways that this individual can receive that service. We are narrowing the population of people that are covered by the abuse statute that experience a mental illness to those that experience a severe and persistent mental illness. The exact definition of that will be in rule. One thing that I want to put on the record about this is that it could potentially increase the workload for some counties that do all of these. We have, I've met with those folks, we've talked about it at length, and what we're going to do is invite them back to talk about how this unfolds over the coming months. So as we move into the next session, we can look to see if there are additional resources that are necessary. But the fixes in this, my understanding is that that is a concern, that we want to note it for the record. We want to acknowledge the work that people do. But the bill itself, even though it doesn't have a fiscal it does, you know, at the county level, people recognize that there will be work that they need to do. The bill also clarifies that if you are a mental health practitioner or a substance abuse practitioner, that you can't have sex with your client. You just shouldn't do that. If you are a licensed professional, your licensing board would discipline you if you did that. But if you are a non-licensed professional, there isn't really a way to get at that, and it's not a crime because the person is over the age of 18. So this just clarifies, you know, you have a lot of people you can connect with, but not your client. Then the other piece related to this is a clarification that AWAPI has the authority to investigate abuse at the Oregon State Hospital. I want to try to put something on the record, and I've asked Justin to do this as well. I had a question meeting with SEIU earlier today. There was a point in time where there was question about whether or not AWAPI had the authority to do an investigation at the state hospital for similar reasons that I described for the community-based mental health programs. So there is a question about what happens to those investigations that took place when it was unclear, and how might that impact people's employment records. Justin Hopkins is going to talk about that, but basically the substantiated allegations from that time would not be put forward into an employment decision or part of a background check. But Justin is going to talk about that. In general, though, that issue is not contemplated in this bill. This just makes the clarification that gets us out of that problem. And finally, that gets us to the mandatory reporting around consensual sexual activity of teenagers, which is in the bill and also in the -2 amendment. A school district recently looked at the mandatory reporting statute in a different way than anybody had ever looked at it before, and determined that, in abundance of caution, all of their staff members who are mandatory reporters, which is everybody that works for a school district, is required to report any consensual sexual activity or conduct or contact between people if one of those participants is under the age of 18. It's important to remember that the term sexual contact also includes kissing. So if you think about a middle school dance or a high school dance, that is a lot of required mandatory reports to law enforcement or to the child welfare hotline. Because people are mandatory reporters 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that would mean that if my daughter came home and told me that she kissed her boyfriend for the first time, even though she's 17 years old, I would be required to call and report that to the child abuse hotline and to law enforcement for an investigation. And I think we can all agree that we don't want that type of barrier in our relationships with our children to be able to have conversations with them. We are all mandatory reporters. So what we tried to do was figure out how we could clarify in the statute that we wanted to just have a status quo of what everybody had understood this to be before, which is that you report anytime you think that there is abuse or any type of sexual activity or contact that is abusive or coercive or between individuals where there is too great of an age range between them. And so that's the language that you see in the bill. We worked on that with the Department of Justice. And we were swimming along okay with that, the idea being that as long as there is not an age difference of more than 3 years between the individuals, and there is no suggestion that there is coercion, intimidation, harassment, then you don't have to report. If you have any concern at all, even just a niggling concern, you can still report. The reason that we have the -2 amendment that changes it to age 12, which I want to acknowledge makes people uncomfortable, because the plain reading of the statute, I've heard people say to me, that suggests that you shouldn't report if you're concerned about two 13-year-olds, or that the legislature is saying that the right age to start having sex is age 12. That's not what this is at all. This is about what is the time that someone is always required to make a telephone call to report that this activity has taken place, whether it's kissing all the way to sexual intercourse. I was contacted late last week and learned that the age of 14 is very problematic for healthcare professionals, because the existing practice and guidance that they have had going back 20 years at least has been to report from age that age is 12. So if we put it at 14 in our effort to create legislation that keeps us at the status quo of where we have always been, that number would be 12. If it's 14, every healthcare practitioner, therapist, counselor, psychiatrist will have to change their practice and their training. And it raises questions about unintended consequences. If a 13-year-old is going to her counselor and sharing with her counselor that she is considering beginning sexual activity with her boyfriend, and that counselor wanted to talk her through her options and whether or not that made sense for her, whether she wanted to delay sexual activity and what consent really is and what a healthy relationship looks like, she would have to report that if she knew that they had been kissing. That, and before she talked with this child, she would have to inform her that if she talked to her about any romantic kinds of things in that way, that she would have to make that report. That is really chilling for getting adults in front of individuals to talk to them about these issues. The argument here is not that the legislature or anyone is saying that 12-year-olds should be having sex. I don't think that is within the authority of a legislature, a judge, anyone except for a child and their family to make those decisions about what is right for them. Do I personally believe that if two 12-year-olds are engaged in sexual activity that there should be a conversation with an adult? Absolutely. But do I think that conversation should come with a knock on the door from a police officer if there was no abuse involved in that? I don't. I don't think that is a positive thing that's moving forward. So what I have with me, and I just got it. We've been trying to track this down, so it'll be up in OLIS for you. But we have that from the Oregon Health Authority Public Health Division, their requirements around mandatory abuse reporting that is age 12. It has a whole list of things that over age 12 you always have to call in, no matter what. And also the legal opinion that was based on back from 1997. From Lindsay Hart, Neal, and Weigler, that argued that the age was 12. And in this summary that the medical professionals in Oregon have based their work on for the last 20 years, the definition of child sexual abuse was sex with a minor who is 11 or younger, sex with a minor 12 or over where there is more than a 3-year difference in age, sex with a minor who is forcibly compelled, sex with a minor who is mentally defective, mentally incapacitated, or physically helpless, sex with a minor who is a brother or sister, child or stepchild, or sex with a minor involving production of pornography or prostitution. All of those things would be reported. In addition, with this bill, it's important to remember you can always report. If there are two 17-year-olds and you think that there is coercion or force or lack of consent, not only can you report, you should report. Anytime you are concerned, you should report. But the bottom line is that Dash 2 amendment is basically the status quo amendment that we continue doing things the way that everybody has understood the law to be for the last 20 years and the way they have practiced, especially our medical community. So I submit to you the Dash 1, the Dash 2, and the bill, and I turn it over to my good buddy, Representative Bill Post.
Thank you, and I thought I was going to be addressing the chair so I could do this.
It's the chair. No.
Oh, well, I know. Chair Canope, how are you in committee?
Good, how are you?
And by the way, welcome Senator Wagner to the jungle.
Thank you so much.
You're going to regret this. I'm here in support of this bill. It came out of a lot of work and discussion. By the way, I'm going to stick to the script because I'm told when I don't stick to the script, I get in trouble. So I'm going to stick to the script. I'm in support of this bill because it came out of a lot of work and discussion involving my school district, the Salem-Keizer School District, which is the second largest district in the state, my teachers and my constituents. I was approached last fall by two McNary High School students who had run an online petition to urge someone to do something about the district's new policy concerning mandatory reporting. And these two young ladies collected hundreds of signatures on that petition from students and parents and educators, and they came to me along with their principal and the superintendent to seek my help. And we all know that teenagers under 18 are more than likely sexually active, probably a lot more so than we'd like for their sake, but it's happening. Those kids don't always have a trusted person to seek counseling and advice from, and in many cases, it's a trusted teacher or school employee. Okay, off script. My wife would be one of those. She's a special ed teacher here in the Salem-Keizer School District, and she is a trusted advisor to kids. And this scared her when this policy came out. It really bothered her. With the district's new policy, that trusted advisor will be required to report the activity to some sort of law enforcement, meaning those kids do not get the help and the advice that they need so badly at that time. It also put the employee, the teacher or the counselor or whatever, in a dangerous situation if they chose not to report. including, as Senator Gelser said, your own child, if you're a teacher. Report your own child. So after much work and a lot of talk, SB 1540 came out. Thanks to Senator Gelser. I had nothing to do with anything. Seriously, she did it all. I'm just going to take a lot of the glory for it. I am very supportive of this bill. I wish young people would refrain from sexual activity at that age, but if they don't, I want them to find a person that they can trust to talk to, and I don't want that person's job on the line. This bill has broad bipartisan support as it is, and I'm not extremely happy with the recent changes being proposed, specifically the drop from 14 to 12. I've had it explained in every way. In fact, we just heard the explanation, but my heart just doesn't like it. And I've wrestled with it mightily since hearing about it this entire weekend. I won't oppose the amendment because my constituents need this bill to move forward. And those two high school girls who I can still envision who were in my office telling me about this worked really hard to raise awareness of this issue to advocate for their schools. And I'm very unhappy that, in a way, some outside special interest groups have come in at the last minute and sort of dabbled in what would have passed from the building in a very strong bipartisan fashion. But I'm going to let that go. It's quite a feat to get two legislators such as us together to come together for a legislation like this, and I don't want to jeopardize that. So I'll just say that I really like the original bill with the Dash One amendment, by the way. I do like that a lot, and I just want to make sure you understand I have heartache, but I want to do what's right for those kids and for the teachers. So thank you for your time.
And I also, Mr. Chair, just wanted to take a moment to thank Representative Post for that. We've had many, many, many conversations since last Thursday. I initially was resistant to putting in the amendment, just because of how far we come, and you know, you've got something that's ready to go, it's on the tracks, everybody's on board, there's no problems, why create turbulence? But I became convinced that we would be making a major policy shift, and that when doctors and nurses, our family practitioners, are telling me that it's unworkable at 14, I felt like we needed to do that. And I have so much respect for Representative Post for not jumping off the bill at that point, and for his strong advocacy for the students and just his real leadership and recognition. And I just want to reiterate again, no one should say that Representative Post is arguing that kids should be running out there and having sex. What he is trying to do and what this bill tries to do is to make sure that all young people have access to trusted adults that they can talk to, that those adults can talk to them in confidence, use their judgment to make a report if there is an abusive situation, but hopefully use those relationships to have good counseling and strong relationships so that young people can be healthy and safe.
Any questions? Oh, great, thanks.
Thank you. All right, so I think I said that we were first going to do the Dash One. So I believe the Dash One is Katie Suver. Yes. And anybody else want to talk about the, would DHS and just come on up just in case, and OSBA? Let's just get it all on the record. Great.
I'll go first.
Yes, that sounds good, since you're the one that signed up. So.
Senator Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Katie Suver. I'm a deputy district attorney in Marion County, here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And my head keeps going back to, I'm here to talk on Senate Bill 101, which was, of course, the Senate bill from last session. The DA's Association has been provided with the Dash One amendments, the language that DHS and the school boards have all agreed would be appropriate. We do not see any problems moving forward with these amendments. We think they would be appropriate and do nothing except to clarify, I think, what the intent of the bill was last session. So we agree they are a good fix.
Thank you.
Chair Gelson, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the legislative coordinator for child welfare, and I just want to thank Senator Gelser and our partners with the DAs and the School Board Association and law enforcement also for working with us to further clarify the statute, and we hope that this will bring us to where we need to be. Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, Lori Satinsville for the Oregon School Boards, ditto to everything that's been said. We are about protecting students, and we're grateful that we could all get together and do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, anybody else want to be heard on the Dash 1 amendment? No, all right. Go through my little list here. All right. So now we're back to the not everything that's not in the Dash 2 amendment. So I'd like to start with Justin Hopkins. All by yourself. Actually, I just have three people signed up on this. So Justin Hopkins, Bob Junedef, and Heather Jeffries.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Justin Hopkins. I'm the director of the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations. We're a shared service between the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. The purpose of my testimony today is to provide the committee with information regarding gaps that currently exist in Oregon's laws to protect vulnerable populations from abuse. Under the current law, some of Oregon's most vulnerable individuals are not protected from abuse when they are receiving services. Senate Bill 1540 addresses those gaps. The current law does not currently protect individuals who are living with a severe and persistent mental illness who maybe have their services funded through the Oregon Health Plan, and it certainly does not include patients who are at the Oregon State Hospital, Oregon's highest level of mental health care. The current definitions of abuse that exist in ORS 430 for individuals living with mental illness are inconsistent with the definitions that apply to people living with a developmental disability. There are clear definitions for abandonment, financial exploitation, verbal abuse, and neglect that protect people with developmental disabilities. However, a person living with a mental illness is not currently protected from those types of abuse. Senate Bill 1540 also expands the existing definitions for sexual abuse to include situations where a substance use disorder treatment professional or a mental health professional engages in consensual sexual relationships with their clients. While licensing and certification boards currently enforce ethical standards on this issue, it's not considered sexual abuse. And lastly, Senate Bill 1540 creates statutory protections from abuse for individuals receiving substance use disorder treatment in residential settings. As I testified in January, over the past 3 years, OHA has received several reports of complaints occurring in residential programs, but none of those complaints were able to be investigated as abuse by the department. Some examples of those different types of abuse or incidents included withholding clients' medications as punishment, physically assaulting clients by hitting and kicking them before allowing them to go outside, sexual assault, forcing clients to assault each other as part of group therapy sessions, forcing clients to live in moldy and unsanitary conditions, punitively forcing clients with physical disabilities to go up and down stairs, and several reports of financial exploitation. And while each of these complaints were investigated by the Oregon Health Authority, by their licensing division, there were really no meaningful ramifications for the individuals who were alleged to have committed these acts. There were certainly licensing implications for the program, but nothing for the specific individuals unless there were criminal charges that were pursued. So Senate Bill 1540 aims to resolve all of these gaps in the law. I would like to take a moment just to acknowledge a few areas that will be important to address for the successful implementation of this bill. Investigating abuse in substance use disorder treatment facilities, particularly in detoxification facilities, will require some specific training and consideration for investigators and for the providers. And OWAPI is committed to working with its partners at the table here to help facilitate a successful rollout for those changes. Senate Bill 1540 changes the statutory definitions regarding the populations who are protected from abuse, as well as the types of abuse that apply to those populations. OWAPI is going to need to update the Oregon administrative rules governing the procedures for these abuse investigations, and we want to make a strong commitment that we'll have an inclusive rules advisory committee comprised of our key partners to ensure that the definitions and the procedures are developed in a collaborative manner. We're also committed to working with the community mental health programs and other behavioral health providers to monitor the impact that all of these changes could have on their workload. And as the chair mentioned earlier, we're going to be happy to report our findings back to this committee prior to the next session. I also wanted to make a note that we continuously strive to improve our investigation procedures and to ensure that each person is afforded adequate due process if they're substantiated for abuse. And as we make changes that could result from Senate Bill 1540, we want to make sure that we continue to use information that we get from people and provider organizations as we conduct our investigations to continue to make improvements. I also understand that there may be some questions from the Oregon State Hospital, employees at the Oregon State Hospital, about how abuse information could be used in the past, or past abuse information could be used in the future. OSH, the Oregon State Hospital, as an employer, has very broad authority to monitor and investigate the conduct of its employees. OWAPI has conducted abuse investigations and gathered a lot of objective information in the course of those abuse investigations. The Oregon State Hospital may have acted on substantiated abuse, but they were also acting on information obtained throughout those investigations that made it into those investigation reports. So it's my understanding that in most cases where OWAPI investigated abuse and determined that it was substantiated, the employee conduct also violated other Oregon State Hospital personnel policies. Since the time that we discovered the gap in the law where patients at the Oregon State Hospital were not covered by the law, DHS and OHA have put in safeguards to ensure that substantiated abuse from the past is not used in a background check for future employment for those employees. Once this gap is filled, that abuse information moving forward would be eligible to be used in a background check. So I'll stop there. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Justin? Thank you very much, and thanks for all your work on this and all of the immediate responses to the many, many phone calls.
Thank you. I really appreciate your commitment.
All right. Heather.
Yes. Hello, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Heather Jeffress. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Prevention, Education, and Recovery Association, and I wanted to thank you for this opportunity to provide testimony and for working in partnership with Justin and other folks on this bill. So I just want to tell you a little bit about OPERA. OPERA is a statewide organization of providers, almost 30 providers across the state of Oregon, serving services all the way from early prevention through detox services. We serve annually thousands of folks on their road to recovery, and we are in support of this bill in regards to its consistency and intent to have clear and collaborative outcomes for our clients and patient safety. So we are really happy to be here and be able to be partners in this testimony. We greatly appreciate the collaboration and coordination taken in creating this bill and look forward to continued partnership with you and the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention Investigation and, of course, the Oregon Health Authority as this work moves forward and our other collaborative associations. We support the considerations of future activities, including working together to lift sustainable patient operations and functions for all of our system partners. As Justin and I said, this is a group effort, and I think it takes all of us to create good client patient safety. We hope this work continues to enhance ongoing quality assurance and monitoring to protect patient safety, also providing opportunities and forums for strengthening patient safety systems and supporting resources as needed as we create improved systems. We also support and are pleased to continue collaboration that bolsters systems and operations that prevent abuse, particularly rules, definitions, technical assistance, any infrastructure or implementation processes. We also are hoping, as we work together, that we ensure all of our partners further develop a robust infrastructure that has clear common sense, standardized processes from reporting through due process, also to improve the outcomes of patient safety so that those things that Justin mentioned lessen and the risk lesson and that we have improved outcomes. And then also, OPERA is particularly eager to grow our partnership in the future work related to the above-mentioned actions as they support detox and really bringing detox into the fold and looking at supporting clients when they are really in their most vulnerable state detoxing from their substance use disorder. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Bob.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon. One of the tasks that Disability Rights Oregon has under federal and state law is to investigate complaints of abuse and neglect, and that's something that we do in institutions and in the community. Way back in 1991, Disability Rights Oregon, I sat on a work group that worked on creating the very statutory framework that we have now for investigation of abuse of people with psychiatric disabilities and developmental disabilities in the community. It happened then because we were at that point moving away from an institutional model of care to a more community-based model of care, and there were individuals who were quite vulnerable in the community who could be subject to abuse or neglect in residential facilities or in community settings, and the legislature wanted to step up and do something about that. And so the statute that we're talking about was put into place back then. In the intervening years, Oregon moved from a model of funding its mental health services strictly through county government to a model where much of the mental health services are funded through Oregon health plan providers. And that affected this statute and the authority that exists under this statute. In addition, during that period, the Oregon State Hospital, much to its credit, moved the task of investigating complaints of abuse out of their own staff to OAPI, the state agency that's empowered to do those investigations, so that they could have, as I recall it, a more independent look at allegations and the creation of reports that then could be returned to the state hospital administration for evaluation. I think it's very important to remember that the county abuse investigation function and OAPI have no greater authority than to investigate, make findings, and create a report. They then pass that report on to agencies that are authorized to issue licenses, both for facilities and for individuals. And so having a good independent investigatory body, and also the ability of counties to provide protective services if immediate intervention is necessary to protect people from harm, is very, very important. And for those reasons, we strongly support the changes that the Senate Bill 1540 would bring in order to make sure that vulnerable people are protected.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Nope. See, great job, everybody. Thank you so very much. All right. Anybody else on that part? Yes. Good to see you again. Thank you for driving to Corvallis on Friday.
Right. Senator Kelser, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. As Senator Kelser mentioned in her opening, the community mental health programs are concerned about the potential workforce impacts of this bill. We appreciate her concern of that, as well as we've had long conversations with Justin Hopkins and OAPI, and look forward to working with him on the rulemaking as this bill moves forward. And we look forward to coming back before the committee during the interim when we have more data on what the workforce impact is, and we can look ahead to the next biennium for if funding is needed to help counties do carry out these kinds of investigations. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Barber? Thank you very much. All right. Anybody else on this part of the bill? Or any other part of the bill that is not the Dash 2 amendment? Or the child abuse reporting piece? All right. Great. So I am down to three people. Brendan Murphy, Megan Foster, and Courtney Dresser. And we're going to let Mr. Murphy go first. Welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brendan Murphy, members of the committee. I'm a deputy district attorney for Marion County, Oregon. I supervise the child abuse and sexual assault prosecution team. I'm also the co-chair of Marion County's child abuse multidisciplinary team, and I'm here on behalf as well of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I would first like to offer several statements around the basic language contained in this bill. And I think as a basic premise, I think we can all agree that we need to do a better job recognizing and protecting kids from abuse, right? Obviously, I know that Chair Gelser and other members of this committee have previously given very strong leadership on that and are strong stalwarts for protecting children. But I do think we all need to acknowledge we still need to do a better job recognizing and protecting kids from abuse. So one of the ways we do that is by making report around suspicious and concerns around children mandatory. They're mandatory reports. And one thing that I do want this committee to consider when you think about these amendments is that if we were good at identifying abuse in the first place, then we wouldn't need to make these reports mandatory because people would be making them naturally. Furthermore, and I train people, hundreds of people, on mandatory child abuse reporting, in my experience, people are hesitant to make a mandatory child abuse report. There is a pervasive resistance to reporting. And I think one of the reasons that there is that resistance is because people associate mandatory reporting with criminal charges. In fact, I think that we've seen conversation around that occur. I think that's an incorrect correlation. It's more accurate to look at mandatory reporting as a snapshot of information that allows us to assess whether or not children are safe and whether that a school response is appropriate or a DHS informal intervention, a phone call is appropriate, or DHS needs to knock on a door or law enforcement needs to do a criminal investigation. We let experts figure out, based on the information they have, the safest way to respond for children. And therefore, I believe that mandatory reporting should be a net that casts wide enough to catch more than just one type of harm. It should capture whether children are physically healthy, whether they have mental health, whether they're exposed to neglect, to have risk of harms, and not just whether or not they are exposed to criminal victimization. Nevertheless, despite that and in light of recent analysis of the bill, ODAA recognized that there was an opportunity for narrow clarification around Oregon's duty to report, specifically, again, around consensual but for age teenager sexual activity. I would like to point out three things about this bill that I think are critical moving forward that I know Chair Gelser has already briefly mentioned on that I think need expounding. Even though there are three types of non-consent listed in this bill, I want to be very clear that the way that the Oregon District Attorneys Association reads this bill, and I think it's accurate, is that this list is not exhaustive. So this bill would make it so that any type of non-consent is still reportable and that has no connection to age. So at any time, if anyone is concerned about a child who is engaged in any kind of sexual activity and there is any question whatsoever around consent, you make the report. In addition to that, I want to be clear that mandatory reporters should not do their own investigations to determine whether or not the children are within 3 years or determine whether or not there was true consent. If there's any suspicious or concerning behavior, make the report. And finally, I would like to point out that the 3 years exception, the standard, the legal standard for that is a reasonable cause to believe based on our analysis of the bill, meaning that someone can not make a report, assuming that parties are within 3 years, and so long as that's reasonable, it wouldn't lead to someone filing violation charges for failing to report. So in other words, I would ask, this bill is essentially that if teenagers between the ages of, we're going to talk about that, are within 3 years, and if there is no concern about consent, there is a narrow exception to making the report. But I do believe that from a public safety standpoint, the Dash 2 amendments are no longer narrow. Remember, as a child abuse responder, we only get snapshots of pieces of information to put that puzzle together, and I can tell you that experts need as many puzzle pieces as possible to get an accurate picture. And oftentimes, one of those pieces is problematic sexualized behavior that may appear otherwise consensual. Sometimes that's promiscuity, sometimes that's hypersexualized behavior, but we know, and it's in DHS publications, that evidence of sexual activities may be an indicator of abuse, and so we need to be extremely careful when we agree, especially with a resistance to making mandatory reports, a lack of a good understanding about what is child abuse, we need to be extremely careful before we carve out larger exceptions. We've done a poor job listening and protecting college-age gymnasts and Boy Scouts and altar boys and kids at football camp. We need all the help we can get in identifying and protecting our kids, and I have no qualms in saying that 12 and 13-year-olds engaged in sexual intercourse are a concern. And I also want to be clear, I never heard anyone else suggest otherwise in this around this bill. But it is very difficult to do this work, and we're missing too many already. So to carve this exception makes me nervous. I encourage you to reconsider the Dash 2s and instead advance the exception that was originally drafted, that was carefully designed to be narrow, reasonable, and that it was vetted with multi-party input. We don't believe that this reduction to 12 is whole child safe. And in short, we'd ask that you vote no if the Dash 2s pass. I'm happy to field any questions. I know this is a difficult issue, and again, I want to be clear. I want to thank Senator Gelser for her leadership in child safety. But at this point, the Oregon District Attorney's District Attorney's Association stands in opposition of the Dash 2s.
Thank you very much. Yes, welcome.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Megan Foster. I'm the Prevention Program Coordinator at the Oregon Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. We're a statewide nonprofit organization with over 100 multidisciplinary members working to improve the response to and prevention of sexual violence in Oregon. I'm pleased to provide testimony today in support of Senate Bill 1540, including the Dash 2 amendments. I specifically want to speak to our support of Section 1, which modifies the definition of child abuse for purposes of mandatory reporting. The Sexual Assault Task Force works to eliminate the root causes of sexual violence in order to stop sexual violence before it occurs. We believe that it is possible for Oregonians to successfully address and prevent sexual violence in our institutions, our communities, and relationships, and to promote a peaceful and safe and healthy environment in which all Oregonians can live and thrive. The spirit of Senate Bill 1540 aligns with the mission of the Sexual Assault Task Force, which is to advance a collaborative, survivor-centered, trauma-informed approach to the prevention of and response to sexual violence in Oregon. A basic tenet of our work to reduce violence is to ensure that youth have access to age-appropriate, medically accurate information, allowing them to make thoughtful and informed choices about their relationships and their health. The current interpretation of the law in some parts of our state instructing teachers and staff to report consensual sexual activity reduces the likelihood that youth will access a trusted adult when they need them, while simultaneously straining an already burdened system with unnecessary reports. Opening opportunities to promote healthy and safe attitudes and beliefs about sexuality will not only reduce unintended pregnancies and transmission of sexually transmitted infections, but will encourage youth to engage in and build a culture of consent, reducing and eliminating violence and abuse. For this reason, we encourage your support of Senate Bill 1540. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Ms. Dresser. Good afternoon. I'm Courtney Dresser. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association, here to speak on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association. the chair described this bill very well, including what the Dash 2 amendment is. Currently, the providers in our community, the physicians that I represent, live within these OHA guidance, which allow them to be a mandatory reporter, but also to be a provider of health care to any child in this particular space from 12 it up regarding sexual contact, which could include kissing and other things, to just ensure that we have a safe environment to have a discussion with them about safe sex and reproductive health and other things like that. We want to continue to live in the environment that we live in right now, in the world that we live in right now, and that Dash 2 allows us to continue to provide our services the way we do now. And so we would ask that the Dash 2 be part of the bill as it moves forward. Great. Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Great. And Courtney, just a question for providers. If providers are concerned that that a 12-year-old or a 15-year-old is engaging in hypersexualized activity or activities that might point to other issues, are they precluded by Oregon Health Authority guidance right now from making that report, or would they make that report?
So, and Chair Gelser, members of committee, in my discussion with some of my providers in this, they err on the side of reporting than not reporting. They have a lot of experience. They have many of them, especially our pediatrician offices, now have kind of team-based care approaches where they have psychologists and childhood development specialists in their offices, behavioral health specialists in their offices. They have discussions. They make sure that they are talking about cases and reporting whenever they see anything and suspect any sign of abuse. They take their reporting responsibility. They take their responsibility very importantly, and they agree that they should report anything that they see. But they also do see, you know, a 13-year-old talk about kissing someone, and they want to make sure that that is still an opportunity, take that opportunity to start having those discussions that need to be had.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for the panel?
I had one quick one. Is it Mr. Murphy?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry. So in addition to my now 28 hours of legislative service, I am an elected board member for our local school board. And I was wondering, just out of curiosity's sake, what work the district attorneys do working with school districts on working on prevention education for underage sexual activity. Are you aware of things that we might be able to implement at a school district level?
Absolutely, Senator, Madam Chair. I would say that the Oregon District Attorneys Association, by statute, district attorneys must co-chair the child abuse multidisciplinary team of their county. And one of the mandates of child multidisciplinary teams are to help prevent child abuse. And so we do have committees, specifically in Marion County, we have a committee called Sexualized Behavior in Children Under 12, in which case we learn and staff and talk about ways of preventing and coordinating appropriate response for children who are exhibiting hypersexualized behavior. And so there are other committees like that around the state. They're called different things. I would encourage you to contact your local district attorney. I'm in your district, so if you have questions about who that is, we can talk afterwards.
But and Mr. Foote.
I know that Mr. Foote has a committee that's exactly the same as ours, and they coordinate with the school about appropriate outreach and education on how to make sure that children are safe.
I was just hoping to speak to that as well, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. As the prevention coordinator for the Oregon Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force, I do know that both Aaron's Law and the Healthy Teen Relationship Act, which are violence prevention legislation that was passed in 2013 and 2015 here in Oregon, require schools to do violence prevention programming in those schools. And I know that the new health education standards and performance indicators, for example, are a great resource for looking at violence prevention and supporting teachers for implementing that programming. I also know, working with community-based programs in Clackamas, Washington, and Multnomah counties, that they're working with schools. There are several programs working with schools on violence prevention and sexual health promotion and just healthy relationships and all those pieces for healthier and safer kids. So there's a lot of great resources to support the MDT and other programs that he mentioned as well.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all so much for all your work.
Mr. Murphy, I don't see your testimony online. Have you put it up to OLAS? Is it on OLAS?
No, I was going to testify orally. I can certainly do that. I have it written if that
I saw you reading from it, and I think it would be handy to have as reference. Thank you.
Of course.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. I am going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1540. Senator Knope left, is not feeling well. He was okay with moving forward with work session. Are you guys okay with having your Thursday free?
well, if that's the choice.
You want to carry over? Or
no, I'm asking to open the work session.
Ready to roll.
All right. Yep. I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 1540, and I'm going to pass the script to
Madam Chair, I move that we move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 1540.
Do you want to do the dash ones first?
Okay.
Just go in numerical order.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 1540, correct? 1540.
Yeah. Gosh, there's so many of them. All right, so Senator Montes Anderson moves the dash one amendments dated February 2nd, 2018 to Senate Bill 1540. Is there any discussion? This is the investigations at school. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendments into Senate Bill 1540.
Senator Montes Anderson moves the Dash 2 amendment dated February 5th, 2018 into Senate Bill 1540. Is there any discussion?
Just a comment. If any of you have worked in a school-based health clinic with middle school students, it would be very difficult. I'm a retired public health nurse, and I was a school-based health clinic nurse, and dealt with 12 and 13-year-olds. And most 12 and 13-year-olds aren't sexually active, but if we don't pass the 12-2s, it would make it very difficult for a nurse to be able to communicate with a child who is coming forward and who is obviously sexually active.
Thank you. And I would just add again, I really appreciate the concerns that are raised about how important it is to report and how important it is to cast a wide net and report anytime there's a concern. I think this Dash 2 isn't arguing that. It's you should report anything that you're concerned about, including if it's 2, 17 and 3/4 year olds, and there is any concern that it is an indication of risk, of harm, of manipulation, of force. The issue of the Dash 2 is, when is it absolutely mandatory that you have absolutely no choice to call? And I don't know, I don't know how I would have gotten through my kid's middle school experience without calling a child welfare hotline multiple times a week based on listening to the conversations of the girls in the back of my car about who they were snuggling with after the dance. And I don't think that that is what that's for. Now, there were other times when I made phone calls about other behavior that sounded concerning or coercive or difficult, and that I did call and would call and just want to put on the record very, very, very strongly, regardless of what the age is, if you are concerned about any type of abuse, you should always call. And then the screeners will do that. It's not our job to do the investigation. But I believe the Dash 2 to be the status quo of what it is today, what everybody understands. So that's where I am. Senator Linthicum.
I have reservations about that. We heard valid competing arguments and how that impacts. I think the point of focus, the senator just spoke to sexual activity. The point of focus, sexual activity versus sexual abuse versus coercion versus, and if you can coerce a 12-year-old into having sex, then you can coerce a 12-year-old into calling it consensual. And so I'm not sure that I think it's very tenuous and dangerous ground for us to be driving all the way back to the innocence of a 12-year-old. Now, realize I'm an old-timer, and I still have this worldview that says that the hookup culture is not healthy for young people, and it's actually for everyone on this committee, it's not healthy for you either. But and I think there is a real danger for just making these grand assumptions about consensual activity and age difference and whatnot and all of those kinds of things that we're actually putting into law. And I think we had the one individual who said, we err on the side of caution. Everybody in the organization errs on the side of caution. I think that human intelligence, our own wisdom, our own knowledge of circumstances and situations, and our own ability to communicate and err on the side of caution is better than creating a statute that demands compliance in these areas. So I'm hesitant. Right now I'm feeling like I'll be a no on the Dash 2. I would love to see it. I would love a cleaner world, first of all. But regardless of that, I would love to see the bill as it's written with the Dash 1. The Dash 2 gives me hesitation, and thank you for allowing me to express that concern.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Well,
Senator Wagner.
Yeah, so I'd say to Senator Linthicum that my wife appreciates the comment about hookup culture, so making sure that we're all protected from that sort of behavior. But I would say the comment that you made about coercion, I think, still exists. If there's any suspicion at all that a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old is using any sort of coercion, mandatory report. That's kind of where I fall in this. I would say that I think it's important on the dash twos to say that we're not sanctioning underage sexual behavior. I come at this, you know, from faith or family or whatever way that you approach this issue, and it's hard not to personalize it, both thinking back on experiences I had or experiences my peers had, but especially as a parent of two ninth graders, a seventh grader, and sixth grader. I'm living through this age right now. But I think if there's data decision-making that we need to make, that this is absolutely the right way to go. So support of the amendment and overall the great work that went into the bill as well.
All right. Can we go ahead and call the roll on the dash two amendments? And Senator Knop is excused.
Senator Liscombe. I will answer in the negative.
Senator Lane Sanders.
Aye.
Senator Wagner.
Aye.
Senator Knop.
Excused.
Senator Gelser.
Aye. So the motion passes. Well, now we have to pass the bill. We just did the dash twos.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1540 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral.
No referral.
That was removed. Okay. To the floor with a due pass, as amended with the dash ones and the dash twos, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Amanda Sanderson moves Senate Bill 1540 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and now this is the whole enchilada of everything that we talked about. Would you please, is there any discussion? I forgot, I almost skipped discussion. I was so focused on the enchiladas. It does not look like there's any discussion. I just want to thank everybody that's worked on this. People have worked really hard. And again, I really want to offer my thanks to Representative Post for hanging in there with this bill and really doing such a great job advocating for the students in his district and really listening to what they were saying to him. I just really appreciate his co-sponsorship and sticking with it. Would you please go?
Aye.
Senator Moniz Anderson.
Aye.
Senator Wagner.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cano.
Excused.
Chair Gelser.
Aye. So having received the required votes, the bill goes to the floor. I would like to carry that bill, if that's okay. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1540. We did all four of our bills that were assigned to our committee in 90 minutes.
Wow. There you go.
So that's pretty exciting. Great committee. You're all awesome. We do have a public hearing set on kind of state hospital, kind of patient rights, new superintendent, all that stuff for next week. So stay tuned. But right now we have nothing scheduled for Thursday because we're now a Tuesday Thursday group. But thank you all so much.
Thank
really
you.
Appreciate it. And with that, we are adjourned.